Notice here that this is not only expansion of consciousness, but the expansion of the human being. Notice that an individual human being now had the capacity of what the entire consciousness of the society would have had before. It's like one of the statements that I do like from Joseph Campbell is that modern man has the same complexity mythologically as whole tribes of people in the past. A single modern human being has as much psychic complexity as a whole tribe of people in the past ages. If we have trouble getting ourselves together, it's because there's a lot more to get together. Not only in terms of quantity, but in terms of complexity. Notice that this does not happen little by little. But it's just like evolution always happens. There are little steps and then suddenly there's a quantum jump. There are little exploratory nodules of experience and then suddenly there's a massive jump. And you have a whole new species. Joe Mann was, in terms of evolution, a whole new species from Shang Man. Using the I Ching as divination belongs to a whole different level, a whole different kind of mankind from using the I Ching as a wisdom teacher for yourself. Let's put it more bluntly. When you use the I Ching as divination in a traditional sense, you're supposed to report it. What's this divination? You report it to the emperor, someone else. When you use the I Ching as a wisdom operation, that divination is reported to your inner self, not to someone else, no matter how powerful they are. Notice that the referent doesn't go exoterically, but esoterically. In other words, you're no longer working for somebody else, but you're working for yourself, your inner self. Now, this is a radical change. It is the change that characterizes consciousness, as opposed to just simply experience. It puts experience in the service of your deeper self, of your heart-mind. This is a radical change. So that you recall now the poems that we had from the Book of Songs about the glory of King Wen, the glory of the people of the Zhou, and so forth. Now on this handout sheet, back to where we began this morning, Richard Wilhelm's History of Chinese Civilization. He's talking about how the dynastic setup used to be, that over these communities were the provincial towns where the nobles resided. And now what are these communities? The original Chinese community had a very specific structure. I'll just show you on this sheet of paper and then hold it up for you. The original primordial Chinese community was to divide land into this form. I've made like a tic-tac-toe game and put X's all around. The blank spot in the center, which will now along with the X's, make a circle. Okay, we have a tic-tac-toe board with 9 squares, and the center has a circle. The circle was the well, which was used in common by 8 families. So that the archetypal Chinese community has a 9 quality. This is your 3 square. People are following me. There's a very esoteric reality that's here. which is not brought out in the Tao Te Ching, because it was not available for conscious expression in the Tao Te Ching. It's there in terms of esoteric experience, but not there in terms of hermeneia. It's not there to be talked about. And in the I Ching, it's not there either. It's not in any of the commentaries. Not in any of the original Ten Wangs. It's only in later usage that you find a consciousness of this structure. The first time in Chinese history that you find a use of this is in the Huainan Zi. Now, because of the secret nature of the Huainan Zi and that circle of people, it took a couple of hundred years for this to penetrate to other elements in Chinese society, for other people to get wind of it. And it's not until the 2nd century AD that you begin to find a new kind of occurrence in the Chinese tradition. That occurrence is the appearance of the first commentaries on the Tao Te Ching. Now look what's happened. In the Zhou dynasty, it was all right to have commentaries on the I Ching. It was a radical jump. In Chinese civilization, when you have the first commentaries on the Tao Te Ching, you have another radical jump. The first commentary was by a man named Wang Pi. The University of Hawaii Press has published an English translation of that, which is very good. The second commentary was by a man, we don't really know his name. Chinese word for river is Ho. And his name is Ho Shang Kong. He's the man that lives on the mountain by the river. We don't know who he is, but that's where he is. That's what he is. And Wang Pi and Ho Shang Kong, with their commentaries on the Tao Te Ching, jump up another step. They take what founded the Zhou dynasty, commentaries on the I Ching, so that commentaries on the Tao Te Ching now found a parallel to the Zhou dynasty. They found non-dynastic Chinese society. So that in the 3rd century AD, for the very first time, you have a whole movement which is to organize Chinese people on a non-dynastic basis. On the basis of the kind of language that we would use in a colloquial sense is that you have Taoist anarchy communities spread across China in such a way that there are thousands, if not tens of thousands, all different from each other. Chinese hillbilly communities who do things their own way. And those people do it that way because they live in the next glen. And around our creek, we do it this way. It's that kind of a situation. And it spreads like wildfire in the 3rd century. It brings, not only brings the Han Dynasty down, it forbids there ever, again, they thought, ever being any kind of a central dynasty. The Huainan Zi makes possible the understanding that commentaries on the I Ching helped set up the Zhou dynasty, so that commentaries on the Tao Te Ching would help set up a reign of individuals who don't need any dynasty. In other words, you have a society based on the Tao Te Ching, on Lao Tzu, and not a society based on dynastic comprehensiveness. The old dynastic capital was the palace, the royal palace. Wherever the emperor happened to have his palace, that's also where the capital city was. So you had the emperor who lived in his palace, which was in the capital city, which ran the empire. And the only place where the Tao of heaven was in the emperor. So the Tao in the emperor, who was the emperor in his palace, which palace was in the capital city, which capital city ran the empire. So the five-phase energy cycle was centered, and there you had it. And the Zhou dynasty set this up with the I Ching as its symbolic expression in such a way that they never thought it would ever change. Why would it change? Except that power on that basis can be usurped. The Han was the perfect example of how when you deal with power, if you forget its cosmic ecology, when you forget that, then usurpers can come in because they can make appearances seem like they have the cosmic power. That kind of cosmic empire holds only as long as the makers of it remember to do everything right. And as soon as it starts to get watered down or compromised, it not only falls apart, but it falls into the wrong hands instantly. Instantly. Turns out to be that it's a universal process. In other words, if you build a pyramid system, the integrity of the pyramid will last exactly as long as the top holds its integrity. That is, in the esoteric wisdom tradition, this is exactly the understanding that has come down through the ages, so that, for instance, if you take a look at a contemporary presentation on the back of the American $1 bill, you can find there's the Pyramid of Wisdom. It's on the other side of the Great Seal of the United States. And the Pyramid of Wisdom has at its top the open, all-seeing eye. Because the only way that the system works is that the top is aware that you have to keep everything in integrity. Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty on the scale of universal empire. But men sleep. Not only that, but they daydream. Not only that, they get ambitions. Not only that, they're just darn ornery sometimes. And they want to do it a different way. And so it became understood that you cannot have an exoteric empire. The only way that you can have it is to have an esoteric empire, the empire within. The emperor does not live out there, he lives in here. And if you can't find the emperor in here, keep trying. Notice that the whole thing changes around then. And instead of having the universe as a pyramid, you have the universe as a sphere. The esoteric saying, whose center is everywhere. Now, Chinese civilization, as I say, went through all of these kinds of thresholds and phases. And by the time that you have commentaries on the Tao Te Ching in the 3rd century A.D., Wang Pi, Ho Shan Kong, and then after that there were whole libraries of commentarial literature on the Tao Te Ching. Notice that in the Shang, the I Ching was used as divination. In the Zhou, it was used as a wisdom book to understand the workings of the empire, so that the Zhou understanding of the I Ching was what we would call in the best sense statecraft. And one of the great English language writers on Chinese civilization and Taoism, a man who was at the University of Chicago, his name was H.G. Creel. You might have seen his name. He has a book, we've got a copy of it here, called The Origins of Statecraft in China. And it's all about this kind of material. And we have another book published in Scotland at the University of Edinburgh called The Pivot of the Four Quarters, about how the architectural setting up of palaces and capital cities all has to do with the feng shui, the proper placement and so forth, so that it expresses the archetypal nature of the emperor. And so the architecture of the palace, the planning of the capital city, all of this was tuned to the man, the person, whoever that happened to be. This archetypal Chinese pattern of the primordial villages becomes internalized in the 3rd century AD. So you gather your eightfold path of the trigrams around the mysterious inner center, which is the well of your own self. So that the inner structure of development of the esoteric personality from the 3rd century on was that you have a primordial community inside of yourself that needs to be tended to. And it's tended to by making sure that the eightfold expression of yourself has a well to draw on, that has good, clear Tao. Now this structure, the basic process that characterizes this ancient structure, this primordial structure of the Chinese village, the basic structure that characterizes the relationship of the families in the eight plots to the well at the center is the food. Food is the process of communication between the two. Food is the basic process which then can be used symbolically to indicate the nourishment, so that this pattern holds on the basis of nourishment, food. So that when you interiorize this pattern in the 3rd century AD, there's such a thing as inner food, inner nourishment. So that the ancient Chinese village god of food becomes a symbolic image of an esoteric process happening within. So that you find in the 3rd century AD a very curious juxtaposition made. You have Lao Tzu paired with the Chinese kitchen god. And they become one figure. Now, if you don't know any of this process, if you're not learned, that's not anything that can be understood very easily. And the usual academic thing, East and West, has been to say, well, this is a regression to folk religion. That's usually how the cop-out is stated. Oh, these people regress. Back to folk religion. Well, that's not true at all. They're enormously sophisticated. They're tremendously insightful. There's no regression at all. There is instead a new synthesis. And the new Chinese god, the combination of the kitchen god and Lao Tzu, becomes the most powerful psychic figure in Chinese history from then on. We'll go into it more next week. I'll talk more about this next week. But a whole new figure comes out. And this figure becomes the intermediary, the inner psychic prism by which the individual can have oracular responses from the cosmic book to their own self. It's a process which is very, very difficult to understand if you're not in possession of this material, but becomes extremely easy to understand if you do. and I'll go into it more next week. I'm going to bring a lot of this material out for you. Let's come back to our mandala. Notice here that in the mandala, the basic relationship, the vertical, is between nature and magic. Now you can turn this mandala upside down and you can see that it becomes that vertical of heaven and earth. So that now we're talking about the Chinese tradition, talking about the I Ching. It's very easy to understand that heaven is a magical realm and earth is a natural realm. And the relationship between them is such that man lives in between them. Now, by the 3rd century AD, it became apparent to the Chinese personality that heaven was an inner power. The magic was the inner power. And nature is the outer manifestation of that power. So that the Chinese sensibility changed. It took from the 3rd to the 5th century AD for this change to happen. It just was such an enormous jump. It took a while for it to take hold. And in fact, it took about 600 years for it to really come through in such a form that it could blossom. It sometimes takes that long. It takes a 600-year cycle sometimes for something enormous like this to change. The change can be characterized in this following comparison. Before, the idea was that the emperor lives in his palace in his capital city. Now, when it became apparent that the heavenly magic was inside, nature became the true capital city for man. So that you have the idea of landscape paintings, which suddenly rise in Chinese society. And the first landscape painting ever in Chinese society was done, Kukai Chi, done about 500 AD, somewhere around there, 400 or 500 AD. The English translation of that painting, the Nymph of the River Lo. You see, the feminine energy of the soul is there in this river which makes its way among the mountains. Nature is seen as the complement to the magical interior. So what do Taoists start to do instead of studying their book, like the I Ching? They start being in nature. They start living in the book of nature, bringing their inner magic out. It's a whole radical different jump. You never will see, there never was, a Chinese landscape painting in the Han Dynasty, or the Zhou, or the Shang, never. If you were to ask a cultivated Chinese person now, what is the most characteristic thing that a cultivated Chinese person could do, that would be to have good calligraphy and be able to make a landscape painting. It's an indigenous quality now. In other words, there's a magic in being able to write a language, and complementary to that, a corollary way, there's the magic of being able to make the painting. Notice that increasingly it is the painting which will become the complementary nature to the inner magic. When it first surfaces, it's actually going to those mountains. Those mountains and streams without end is the phrase. you physically get up and leave your place and go to those mountains and streams. But as the sophistication of consciousness attunes itself to this, one realizes that you can have a scroll of those mountains and streams, and that will do just as well in a symbolic abbreviated form of bringing out the inner magic. So if you go to the home of the cultivated gentleman, and you're a very close friend, and you're willing to have plum wine for the space of time it takes for the moon to really come up, at the propitious moment, the landscape painting scroll is hung, laid out, and you meditate together, and the magic is released. This is archetypal of Chinese civilization after the 5th century AD. It increasingly becomes the tone of fulfilled, wholesome life, whereas before it didn't exist at all. Or rather, it existed only in a different form, in a different mode. Now, if you take an overall view, what has happened is that experience has collected itself into increasingly integrated symbolic forms, and when it reached that point, it interiorized. Experience collected together until it formed a threshold, and when it formed a threshold, the threshold interiorized itself. And then expressed itself in the interior, in kind of like an hourglass complement to the way in which it had come in the first place. So that the way in which man collects his experience and brings it to himself, it then interiorizes and expresses in himself, unfolds and differentiates in a complementary way to the way in which experience had been collected together in the first place. It's like a recipe. You're never going to have an interior unfoldment which is inconsistent with the way in which you collected your experience in the first place. Notice that the ethical basis is not on how clever you are to unfold symbolic meaning. That's a natural process, to put it in quotation marks. That happens gratis of the universe. It isn't how clever you are in interpreting. It's how careful you are in the first place to put good nourishment into the hopper. The ethical basis is what did you do? Because that's really what went in. And your whole commentarial interpretive basis within your inner life is going to be exactly commentary on what you actually did. So the place to be attentive is to what you do. Notice that the emphasis comes back, but now it comes back in a conscious way, so that there's a parallel. One is conscious that what you do is important. But in previous times, you paid attention to what you did, not on the basis of its conscious importance, but just so that you could serve the emperor right. So you end up with two sets of people who are both attentive to ritual, but one set for exoteric reasons and the other set for esoteric purposes. You have one set of people who try to do things right so that the things are done right for the person in authority. You have another group who do things right because that's the way that the interior nourishment gets started. Now, someone coming in to a process like this in a naive fashion would not be able to distinguish between all those who are operating esoterically or exoterically. There's no way to distinguish, except by following through to see what happens, what occurs. How do they deal with it? It's almost blasé and bland by now. How can you tell what's happening? Because you can tell by the purposes. You can tell by the purposes. The appearance in reality, in that mix, in the ritual mix, is not able to be distinguished. You can't tell who's who. So there's no way on the ritual level that you can tell. There's no way on the mask level, because everyone's wearing a mask. But there are radically different kinds of uses that the masks are being put to. Everyone's living the drama of life in common, but there's a radical difference between the ways in which you can live. The separating level is that process that we call language. Language, as that transformational medium, we'll see later this year, not only separates the sheep from the goats, it separates the humans from the sheep and the goats. They go in completely different directions. So that in mythology, for instance, you have the ability to have chimeras. You know what chimeras are? Half human, half beast, like a centaur. Half man, half horse is a chimera. You're able to have chimeras in mythology because you're bringing that threshold to equilibrium. But the precipitant of separating the two, so that they're never again able to be confused, is the symbolic. In a myth, a chimera can exist, but on the symbolic level, one understands the meaning, and the meaning transcends this pairing of human and animal. Then it becomes meaningful for human consciousness. So it's a radical jump. Our whole first year process is to raise ourselves up to the mask level and then pay attention to how we use that ritual mask capacity. And how we use it will tell us exactly where we're headed. Are we headed towards the human? Are we headed back towards an authoritarian bestiality, which in its ideal secretly exempts consciousness from our capacity? Secretly says, you will be penalized to the extent that you are conscious. Now you can see that this becomes very protean, especially in Western civilization. Because constantly in Western civilization it's characterized that it's the devil himself who seeks to become conscious in competition with God, who alone has consciousness. The accurate place where this is expressed is in Milton's Paradise Lost. What happens when you speak up? Well, then you're cast out. Where are you cast out? You're cast out into the outer darkness, where the magic happens. You see that all the associative correlations with this jeopardize through fear and terror, through engendering resistances, jeopardize the whole process, so that finding yourself is the most perilous of all actions. Finding your true self is exactly what is most perilous in all the worlds. That is to say, every societal power structure, consciously or not, sets up the quest for self is the most dangerous of all things that you can do. It's only in the 20th century that we have come to understand an ancient hunting technique that, while to do it ourselves in terms of our own culture is really precarious and really takes a lot of strength, when you deal with comparative civilizations, when you see how the Chinese did it and you're not Chinese, or you see how the Indians did it and you're not Indian, or you see how the Arabs did it and you're not Arab, through this comparative technique, you can piece together, by implication, what it is in fact that you're doing. It is, in fact, an archetypal activity. Instead of looking with your eyes directly at a process which is so horrible that it turns people to stone, that's the saying, see? You look into a mirror. Because you're not going to be turned to stone by looking in the mirror. So you use reflection to help you to see what you would be forbidden to see exactly. I hope that you can pick enough out of this so that you can get a sense that we're pulling a kind of strategic jujitsu on the very structures of resistance in our psyche. That's what this whole program is about. Is of doing very easily a kind of a balancing act which in the past was so difficult that only universe of geniuses could do it. Or only somebody who had the incredible doggedness of a Milarepa could just blunt their way through. But a Milarepa comes along in 1,000 years. Whereas this kind of a process allows anybody who just stick to it to do that. Anybody who just does it can do this. Now in our material, one of the structures that we need to pay attention to for next week in the program is the music. And if you turn to page Roman numeral 3, you see the music and spiritual personality and development. I've tried to find selections of music which characterize the stages of development. And the music that characterizes best nature for us, I feel, is this composition by Alan Hovhaness. And God Created Great Whales. Now Don found a cassette of it, and we have some blank cassettes here. You can make copies for yourself, or you can bring copies. I made a copy so that you can at any time bring a blank cassette and make a copy of that music. Hovhaness, who was an American of Armenian-Scottish descent, he had an Armenian father and a Scottish mother, born in Boston. He's an odd character. He's about 6'7". He looked like a huge mystical crane walking around. He took the songs of humpback whales and worked them into a musical composition like a concerto. Now it's interesting. And it takes a very, very sophisticated, feeling-toned consciousness. Mozart and Hovhaness both extended the feeling-toned capacities of man. Hovhaness is the Mozart of the 20th century. Why so? Because he extended the whole range of human feeling so that we can use the songs of another species of life to explore our feelings. Notice the use of comparative interspecies feelings to explore dimensions which would have remained unconscious for man had we have just limited ourselves to the kind of songs that man could sing. This is at once new and ancient. anybody who's been in a real ceremonial of a primordial society knows that man always used to use the language of animals and birds to key in his symbolic vision. Always used to. In the Blackfoot Indian Okan Sundance ceremony, the Itzkinai, the Horn Society, use the songs of the buffalo, Tatanka. And because they know how to sing those songs, they know that kind of magical language and have internalized it, when they're in their Horn Society collection together, nobody messes with them at all. Oh yes, you know these people, and you know that Charlie drinks a lot, and you know that Fred does this, but when they're in the Itzkinai mode, you don't mess with them at all, because they have the power of the buffalo, especially the horns of the buffalo. And they change. And if you've ever seen it, you see it happen. They put the mask on and become the power that the mask has. And it's sometimes not so fearful as the Horn Society. Sometimes, like the prairie chicken, they're like the prairie chicken. Then what they do when they become the prairie chickens, they just move around and listen like prairie chickens. They make all these little pecking motions and they scurry around and they just scurry together. And the women's society, the major women's society, is like the female buffalo. And all their movements and all their sounds are like the female buffalo. Why? Because the men who become in the Horn Society would outbalance by their male power the wholeness of the tribe, so women's society become female buffaloes. We know how to deal with that. And as soon as the Horn Society performs their dances, the female cow buffaloes come out and they perform their dances and put everything back into order. One of the things that women do is they do every movement four times. And once one sees this, you realize that what Hovhaannes has done is he's gone back to a primordial mode. He's gone back to the rock bottom of the ritual reality, but he's done it with high symbolic consciousness also. It's incredible. He's been able to go back and pull this out. Now, in between Hovhaannes and the songs of the Itzkinai, you find Beethoven in the Sixth Symphony, in the Pastoral, who used some bird songs from the Vienna Woods to key in his symphony. And Beethoven took it as far as he could possibly go. But with Hovhaannes, he takes it to the point of penetration. He takes it to the point to where man now shares this planet with the whales and thereby with all the other animal life that's there. It's like mankind has become like a Hiawatha. He's learned to speak the language of the animals, and now he's going to learn to speak the language of the trees. And ask them, what would you ask them? What are you for? Why are you here? And again,